Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to this week's podcast. Today's guest is Frank Portinari, a former Loyalist gunrunner, Brigadier for the London UDA and author of the book Left Right Loyalist From One Extreme to Another. We have so many people on this podcast who were involved some way in the Northern Ireland conflict. That's victims, that is people who were involved in violence. And Frank, you are one of those. And what always intrigued me about your story was that you were born a Catholic Italian in North London, and somehow you ended up involved in the conflict in Britain by joining an Ulster paramilitary organisation. I suppose my first question is, how did that happen?
Well, I'm glad I'm getting an opportunity because, and unfortunately, as far as the media is concerned, and I'm going back a lot of years, this isn't just recent, but there's been a lot of lazy journalism over the years. And once somebody prints something, it gets regurgitated, basically, and very rarely gets challenged. And nobody comes to me. Nobody actually contacts me and asks for any confirmation. So, yeah, it does stand quite a strange story. But when it's told correctly, it isn't really that strange because, yes, I had an Anglo-Italian father, but he left home when I was about two. So there's absolutely no Italian influence whatsoever. And it's only the surname that gives it away. So my mother was Anglo-Irish. So her father was Spillane or Spillan, whichever way people choose to, you know, to pronounce it. So growing up, I only ever knew being a Londoner, being English and being British. So, you know, probably had never even been to Italy until I was about 30. And that certainly wasn't because I was looking for my roots or anything like that. So the Italian Catholic persona doesn't really apply to me. And I went to Sunday school. I didn't go to a Catholic church. I didn't go to a Catholic school. And so this Catholicism bit is a bit strange to me. But that said, I was no more a Protestant. So it's, yeah. You know, I was no more a Protestant. I went Sunday school. When that got shut down, I went to a Methodist church. And probably by the time I went into secondary school, I had no connection with religion at all. And my next introduction to religion was actually when I was in prison. And I used to attend, you know, chaps on a Wednesday night. And then through my own volition, I decided to be baptised. So thanks for the opportunity for me to put that straight, because I read it all the time. I read it on so many, you know, web pages and so on.
So the fact is, Frank, that you actually weren't even a practicing Catholic. You were kind of only a Catholic by name. You never practiced the religion, but you're saying now that probably the media has jumped on that and said, oh, he was a Catholic.
Italian surname, I get that, you know, and by far the majority of Italians are Catholic. I appreciate that. Because of the surname, as I say, so on my father's side, I'm assuming every aunt and uncle, cousin that I ever had, probably were all Catholic. And the same again with my mother, you know, being Anglo-Irish, she would have been the same, but she had a part of the ways with the Catholic Church when she was younger for her own personal reasons. So she never sent me to a Catholic church or a Catholic school, and she could have done, you know.
Was your mum from Ireland, or was she like a second generation Irish?
Her father was Irish.
And was it from Northern Ireland or Southern Ireland?
Southern Ireland, but I've got no idea which part. I've got no idea which county he was from.
So it's fair to say then, Frank, when you were growing up in Camden and North London, religion wasn't a big thing. It wasn't what it would have been in Northern Ireland at all.
No, I probably growing up had more Irish friends and spent more time in Irish households because I didn't spend a lot of time in my own. So I was always in and out of other people's houses. And there were very, very big Irish families in the road that I lived. The majority of my neighbours were Irish. And I never knew them any different from anybody else, to be perfectly honest. I certainly wasn't aware of any troubles. And as I say, I had a very kind of naive view of Irish people in those days. I used to, you know, we used to go to the outside the Irish Cups when we was kids and watch them fight each other. That was great for us. You know, we knew that they owned probably most of the pubs in the locality. And they would get into the back of vans at Camden Town, Murphy's or Lavery's or somebody. So that was the only thing that distinguished Irish people for me, you know.
And at that time, Frank, would there have been an anti-Irish sentiment in London because of the IRA? Because you were obviously born in the 60s and then your teenage years would have taken you through to the 70s. And as we know, the 70s were the worst times of the Troubles in Northern Ireland. I'm trying to think back. I think there was a few bombings in London around the 70s, IRA bombings. Was that something that you were aware of growing up?
No, I would say I was born in 57. So by early, say around 72, I would have been 15.
Okay.
So I'd have known of the post office tower near Tottenham Court Road. I can vaguely remember that being blown up. I could vaguely remember 74, the Birmingham pub bombings. But I wasn't at all politicised at that time. I've said this many times. I would have been very politically naive. My view of the world was Labour was red, Conservative was blue, and I assumed because my parents were workers, I did get a stepfather eventually, that they would be Labour because we were all, you know, we were working class people, you know, outside toilet, you know, tin bath on a nail on the wall. Not a lot of money going around. I mean, that wasn't just us. I mean, that was pretty much the community, you know. So I was pretty politically naive, or just not interested, if I'm honest. I just wasn't interested. And then one night, a group of young people came knocking on the door. They said they were from the Young Socialists. Never had a clue. They seemed genuine, you know, they seemed very idealistic. They talked about employment, housing, education, you know, different things that I could relate to. And they invited me to a local meeting. That was my introduction to politics, basically.
And it was socialism. It was actually socialism.
Yeah. In fact, it was more extreme than socialism because when I actually got to the meeting, there were actually more Workers' Revolutionary Party banners up and flags than what it was young socialists. So this was my introduction to the middle classes. I'd never really met middle class people. I'd only ever known working class people. So that was my introduction. And I threw myself into that for some time. I went to rallies, meetings. I think I sold the newspaper. I'm trying to think what Newsline it was called. So, yeah, I was pretty much a committed socialist at that point. And then I'm trying to think, it was one day at a rally or a meeting, they were very, very critical about the British Army, which I didn't get because I didn't know the history of Ireland. So I didn't quite get that. I wouldn't go so far as to say they openly supported militant republicanism. But they certainly was for United Ireland, whatever that meant, you know, at the time for me. And eventually my mates kind of said, look, what's all this politics like? You know, you're supposed to be playing football with us or kind of coming to football with us. And I basically knocked it on the head. It did bring out a little side of me that I didn't know I had. It brought out a little bit of patriotism in me. I suddenly felt very defensive when they were having the army. And also it got to the stage where they'd be talking about the students in a certain country or workers in another country. And I'd be thinking, oh God, I'm concerned about the workers around where I live. You know, the council workers, the people like that. So in that sense, I suppose people would say that was my first introduction to nationalism as opposed to internationalism. But kept away from politics for a long, long time. Kept away from it for a long, long time. And in the early years, that nationalism, that patriotism, led me to the National Front because someone gave me a leaflet one day. I went to a meeting and I was surrounded by working class blokes who I identified with, people that spoke like me, you know, and a football like me, tended to like similar music. And they weren't very middle class, if I'm honest. So I felt quite comfortable.
And would you say then, Frank, that there wasn't many places that a young working class man in North London felt where he could belong in those days?
Yeah, because where we lived, you'd had a lot of the houses that had been bombed out from the war. So there was a lot of regeneration. And then perfectly good houses that only needed central heating and much better sanitation. Instead, they just knocked about 5, 6, maybe 7 houses down, streets. They completely demolished the community and people moved away from the community. So that wasn't helpful. And you then got situations where schools might have youth clubs of an evening. Mm-hmm. And we had quite a big influx of West Indians that came into Camden. And so obviously they were coming to the youth club. So we wanted to play our music on a little record player and they clearly wanted to play theirs. So it would cause friction. And then, of course, there'd be fights over the table tennis tables, you know, the little snooker tables. Fights would, you know, would take place. And unfortunately, the youth leaders tended to take their part. And that caused a lot of ill feeling. And then what really did it was they then got their own actual youth club, not a school hall. They got their own youth. That caused a lot of ill feeling as well. So there was a lot going on at that time. So, yeah, you could easily be led into a certain way of thinking. And it's why people say to me, is the book Left, Right, Loyalist like a marching theme? And I'm saying, no, it's where I was left. went to the right, and then in the lawn.
Yeah.
And clearly backing up by sand at the bottom from one extreme, because that's been the story of my life. I've gone from one extreme to another.
When you were joining the National Front, can you remember what age you actually were when you joined?
I think it was probably, I get confused. I thought I was about 18, but I actually think I was probably more like 20, somewhere between 20 and 21. So I did have a mind of my own. It wasn't like I was coerced into it.
Did you know that what you were getting into was a racist, fascist organisation?
Yeah. Well, the irony is I didn't, because I was surrounded by people that I knew, because it became a very, very cultural movement, in the sense that in Camden there were lots of music venues. You know, there still are. So different, you know, people with different political persuasions followed different bands and different genres of music. So if you were going to football with your mates, you was going to watch the same bands as your mates, playing football with your mates. You know, you were just part of that group of people. But so I didn't feel necessarily racist in the traditional sense, what people would assume a racist is. But I was certainly very, very patriotic, and I certainly wanted the best for Britain or the United Kingdom. And I threw myself into it, and it was only a matter of time before I became the organiser for Camden. And I went marches and places all over the country and canvassed at election time and so on, and had numerous confrontations with a variety of left-wing groups. In fact, I became quite notorious, to be honest. But again, as I say, I take responsibility for that. But later in life, I've also identified that whatever I'm involved in, I go to extremes. It's just, you know, people might have a drink addiction or gambling or drugs. There's clearly something in me that when I get involved in something, it's all or nothing. I can't abide barstool preachers, you know, and I still listen to them 40 years later complaining about the world and have done absolutely nothing about it, you know. So football, you know, I was an avid football fan, followed Tottenham all over the country, home and away, Europe. That's what happened. I became a football hooligan.
When you say a football hooligan, did you know you were a football hooligan when you were doing it, or did you only realise
that
you knew you were?
Yeah, and again, as I say, situations where, you know, I threw myself into it. I realised that there was a great deal of camaraderie. There was a great deal of trust amongst people. You know, you go up to Newcastle on a Wednesday night, you know, if you're going to come back alive. So you rely on your friends, you rely on the people around you, and you very quickly get a reputation. You know, if people see you fight in an away game, when you go into your own pubs the following week for the home games, people recognise you and people say, oh, fair play, mate, I saw you last week, you know, you stood your ground, you didn't run away, blah, blah, blah. And that's when I was quite young. I mean, that was sort of 16, 17. So for want of a better way of putting it, the reputation was born quite early. And, yeah, I was quite active. I was quite active and had been arrested on numerous occasions. In fact, more luck than judgment that I didn't get imprisoned. I was because I'd had a suspended sentence, then got away. But I got arrested up in Liverpool. And only because the police lied in their statement that I got off, otherwise I definitely would have got a custodial sentence. So I know whatever I get involved with, that I joked with someone the other day. I said, look, I am a religious person, but privately. I'm not evangelical. I don't go around preaching to people. Right? I know if you invited me to a church meeting tomorrow, give it a few weeks, I'll be up in the pulpit. I'll be giving sermons. You know, I'll probably break away like old Mr. Paisley and form my own church. She's no. So I've never been so apolitical. You know, I'm not a member of any political party, any political group, and religion. I try not to talk about it because I don't want to be confrontational with people.
And Frank, but football hooliganism, I mean, we had enough going on here in Northern Ireland without football hooligans. So it's a wee bit alien to a lot of people from here and some people who wouldn't be really into football. But being a football hooligan, I mean, you were going to matches and, you know, you were dedicated supporters of a certain team, but you're willing to get involved in violence and whatever as part of that, basically.
Yeah, and again, you start to realise you have an influence over other people. You start to identify your leadership skills, for want of a better way of putting it. And if you lead by example, you know, people will follow you. Someone said to me a few months ago, Frank, do you feel in some way you've been radicalised? And I laughed and said, no. If anything, I'm the one that's been doing the radicalising. Not necessarily consciously, but over the years, I've questioned a lot of my friends and associates over the years. How many of them stayed loyal to me? Not necessarily the cause. You know, I suspect a lot of them have stayed loyal to me. And I wouldn't be at all surprised if some of them turned around and said, you know what, Frank, the day you retired from all of this, we were so happy because we knew we could as well. Because they wouldn't if I hadn't. So
it's crazy. It's a crazy kind of where you were saying there that, well, I couldn't get involved in the church tomorrow because I'd be up in the pulpit in a few weeks. You can get that easy into things. But at the same time, you have been a leader in certain things, which is clear, and people follow you. It's a strange dynamic, isn't it?
Yeah. And it's only after I wrote the book and I wrote the book as I felt it. It was like people who've read the book have said, it's like talking to you in the pub. You've just written it as if you're talking to us, you know. But that was the idea. That was the whole idea, to just have it straight. I mean, ideally, yeah, I'd like academics to have read it. But I thought the chances of finding it in a university somewhere or a college, you know, on a shelf somewhere, probably wasn't going to happen. So I decided to write it as a working class bloke would write it. And it is a piece of, you know,
conversational
political and social history. So it took some convincing for me to do it because I was a bit self-conscious. But that has helped me identify, because I'm reading about myself, aren't I? I'm writing and reading about myself and thinking, God, is that me? You know, how did I not see certain signs? You know, and I do talks now and again, and I say to people, I call it the treadmill. And I say, you get on the treadmill, you press the green button and you go. And you don't look left, you don't look right, and you don't look behind you. You just keep going. And one day you hit the red button and you get off and you go, fuck, where have I been? You know, how did I get here? You know, why did I get on here? Who helped me get on here? Why didn't somebody else get on here? You know, and there's no safety mechanisms there, is there? You know, because you wasn't looking for any before you got on there. Well, I would now. Anything I did now, I think, hold on, you know, what could go wrong here? So I say that, that's some of the talks that I do. I say to people, look, you need to be really careful, because what you might just see as enthusiasm and wanting to please could be something else. I mean, I met a great employee because I go to extremes. I try to please as much as I can. You know, you get your money's worth out of me, if nothing else. But it's definitely something there. There's definitely something there.
Do you regret any of the things you've done?
Honestly, not really. And you can imagine how many times I've asked myself that question, and certainly other people have. And I would say the usual answer I give to that, my big regret, is the irony is the people I hurt the most were the people I cared about the most, which was my own family. So I'm not particularly proud about that, that's for sure. And I think I'm a very lucky man to still have that family, quite honestly. But I will say this. I'm not being blasé about it, far from it. But it's a lot easier sitting here knowing that I haven't actually killed anybody. And it's not like there wasn't intent, because there was intent. But I haven't actually killed anybody. So I'm pleased. I'm very, very pleased I've not taken somebody's life. By the same token, a weapon that I may have supplied over the years could quite easily have taken somebody's life. And I say this, you know, an innocent man may have been killed. His mother might have died of a broken heart 6 months later. His wife might have had a nervous breakdown, and his children have been traumatized ever since. Well, I wouldn't feel very proud about that. I wouldn't feel much of a soldier. But because it's not happened, it's difficult for me to confront. And I'll be perfectly honest with you. You know, sometimes I've had nightmares where modern forensics have suddenly identified a gun that I've supplied. And I'm in court again. I actually, you know, live the dream or the nightmare. But I'm standing in a court being tried for something again. So it's a very, very difficult question, because I'm not, that's not happening.
You don't know the reality of whether the guns you supplied to the UDA killed somebody. And most likely sadly, they probably did, Frank, because
quite possibly.
In the time that you were supplying guns to the UDA, it was probably the UFF at that time in the mid-90s were carrying out, they were out, and I don't like using this term, but it has been used before, out killing the IRA at that time. And that's something you don't know. And I suppose maybe with what you're saying there, that you don't know that answer, and that's how you cope with it.
Yeah, that is a little bit of a safety mechanism, to be honest, because I remember a chap who was a UVF volunteer, Billy Giles. And, you know, from what I've read of the story or listened to the story, he was a young man, you know, churchgoer, came from a good family, felt compelled to join the UVF, killed somebody and he couldn't live with it. And eventually he killed himself. You know, so it's a very, very difficult one. And I said this the first open visit with my wife, because up until then it had been behind screens. And even at the first open visit was still a category A visit. You weren't on the normal wings, you know. You were sitting there with two prison officers either side of you. And I said to my wife, I'm glad I got caught. And she said, what do you mean? Can you want to get caught? And I had to say to her, where did you think this was going to end? You know, you can't be in charge and you can't have guns wrapped around you and not use them. So I think that's the first time she actually sort of realised to what extent I was involved. It wasn't just trips with the boys to Belfast or Londonderry or Glasgow or Liverpool, Manchester, wherever, just how serious it was. And she suddenly said to me, are you telling me you'd have shot somebody? And to this day, I don't think I actually gave her a straight answer. I think I just kind of went, you know, I made some sort of gesture. But I genuinely mean that. I was genuinely pleased that I got caught, because it was only going to end one way. And I said to people, I don't think people appreciate what life was like in Northern Ireland for all sides. And I'm convinced that if I'd have lived in Northern Ireland, I'd have been dead, or I'd have been dead with a life sentence. I'm quite convinced about that.
That prison term that you did was from 1994, after you were caught in 1993. You were arrested in the car park of a Birmingham pub with seven guns and over 240 rounds of ammunition. You were only 36 at the time. You worked as a school caretaker. It was found that you had the guns hidden in a room in the school. We'll get to that, Frank, but I want to take you back just to when you were growing up in Camden and you were going through the football hooliganism stage and you were, you know, you were trying to live your life as well. Had the criminality consumed you to an extent that you didn't really care about your future?
No, because any criminality at that stage was very petty.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very petty. See, the thing is, some people say it's because you didn't have a father figure. I didn't have any older brothers. So I radiated to older men, you know. So a lot of influences were me trying to keep up with older men, whether that was drinking, whether that was fighting. You know, I remember some fellas I worked with who were, you know, were basically villains, you know, and they asked me to look after a bear one day. It was actually a sack. And being a teenager, you know, you're going to look in the sack. And there was sort of shotguns and, you know, balaclavas and gloves and so on. But I wasn't a villain, you know. And the irony is that some of the people I knocked about with that were, I kind of came to the decision quite early. I didn't want to be out with my girlfriend sitting in a restaurant having a meal and another firm of geezers coming in and, you know, shooting at me and accidentally hitting her. Or getting beaten up. So it's ironic, really, that I could quite easily make the decision to not be a villain, but didn't talk myself out of being a paramilitary, which was even more dangerous. So it is a strange one, I grant you, you know. But I wasn't. So I think people get confused sometimes because when they say, even people in prison said to me, "How much money did you get for the guns?" And I'd say, "Well, you know, well, you know, how much did you sell them?" I said, "I didn't sell them. I gave them willingly," and they couldn't understand that because they were villains.
So you kind of were on the fringes of gangsterism in London, basically, Frank. And when did you start to drift towards Ulster loyalist paramilitaries? Like, how did you even become aware of that in London?
Well, I think what did that, apart from the fact that the, you know, the National Front is obviously a lot of their publications and propaganda was very much for, you know, for Ulster, you know, keep Ulster British, you know, and so on. So I did start to get a little bit more knowledge and I started to interact with people from Northern Ireland that had come from Northern Ireland to live in London. So there were some personal relationships that got built up. And you've got to remember that there was a lot of support for, I'll say for United Ireland, equally was a lot of support for the IRA. And there was some support, to a lesser degree, for the likes of INRA. And then I suppose, you know, eventually, you know, the IPLO and so on, and various other factions. But we would have various places. Look, people going to collect money in pubs, you know, buy a bullet. You know, be sitting in a pub and people would come in and it'd be buy a bullet, you know, pay, make a donation. People selling troops out of magazines. So we would get into confrontations. And then you would have far, far more violent situations when there'd be parades or marches, I should say. So,
and this was in London, these marches, and these would be what type of marches would
in London at the beginning of the year, say January, you would have the troops out, would have the Bloody Sunday parades, which in itself, I don't take offence at that. What I used to take offence at was the fact that at the beginning of those parades, there would be Republican bands, usually from Scotland, and they would be playing pro-IRA tunes. So to me, that changed what that parade was for. That just wasn't about getting justice for, you know, mm-hmm. for those victims. that was something else. There was a political message as well. And then in August, you'd get the internment parade. Now, that would be the Irish Freedom Movement. But what tended to happen was, sometime before those parades, there'd be a bombing on the mainland. So we kind of took the attitude, hold on, you know, that's just a little bit of a liberty, you know, that you're going to walk down our streets. And funny, I find it ironic because in Northern Ireland, you know, I've heard people say, oh, we don't want orange parades, you know, or marches coming through or on the outskirts of our community. I think, well, that's a bit ironic because your supporters on the mainland used to march up our streets playing IRA tunes. So if that wasn't provocative, I don't know what was. So we'd get into confrontation. And eventually, and the same way the police would know us from the violence of football, the police very quickly, you know, police quickly recognise you that you're, we'll say, I say loyalist then. We were probably, most of my associates were probably British nationalists, I would say. We hadn't quite got to that stage of, you know, being classified as loyalists, although we knew quite a few. But eventually, I think the penny dropped and we thought, well, hold on, this isn't exactly equal, is it? We're attacking a parade and throwing a few punches. You're blowing us up. That doesn't seem equal to me. And I think that's when people said, no, we're not having this. But it's easy saying it. But what did we do about it? We weren't. But most of us, and here's something else I don't think people realise. The amount of people that I associated with that were actually from Irish heritage. You know, you'd actually be surprised how many people on the pavement that was attacking these parades had one or two Irish, you know, grandparents, some cases an Irish parent. But as far as they were concerned, they was Londoners. And, you know, and they were born in England and they were British. And that might come as a shock for some people.
Were people then associating protesters with these marches? Were they associating them with the IRA, even though that wouldn't necessarily be the case?
Because you had people at the beginning of at the parades who would be polite and say they were Sinn Féin. As they say, the dogs on the street knew who they really were. You know, and then when you had people, you know, like Ken Livingstone and John McDonnell and Jeremy Corbyn, you know, making them welcome in London as well, you know, County Hall, the Houses of Parliament, various town halls around us, particularly Islington. You know, we suddenly thought, hold on, you know, these are supposed to be British MPs. What are they doing walking with these people and bands that, you know, go, IRA. Well, you can't get more explicit than that. That's not, you know, that's not trying to pretend to be anything else. So that was the thing. So they got the parade on the basis of it was justice, you know, for the victims of you know, it was a bloody sunny march. As I say, in August, it was internment had ended years before, but they insisted on having these anti-internment parades. So what the general public, so in the newspapers, you know, it would be, that's what those parades before. But we knew there were elements on that parade, particularly the more extreme left wing, who were very much for the IRA and very much for England. So for want of a better way of putting it, that's who our argument was with, you know, and that's who we physically wanted to engage with. And then eventually, none of us were in the Orange Order. None of us were apprentice boys. We probably would have sided more with Rangers than Celtic. That's how tenuous the link was, you know. But eventually, as I say, over a course of time, people got more politicised and there was more talk of militancy.
And did you, Frank, can I ask, did you hate Republicans or did you hate Catholics or did you hate both?
Republicans, the better. Okay. Perfect moments. The cavalry man standing next to me attacking a parade. So, you know, and eventually I know. See, but then again, none of us were religious. So even if you referred to yourself as Catholic or your family were from had a Catholic heritage, which mine certainly did, you know, that wasn't the issue. We, as far as we were concerned, we were Londoners for a start. You know, this was our city. We didn't take kindly to people playing up and marching through singing IRA or in that. We were British. Those were the things that bound us together. Nothing to do with religion at all. And eventually we knew there were orange parades occasionally in London and apprentice boys parades. And we made ourselves known. You know, there'd be 25, 30 of us would go along. And the irony is, the Orange Order and the Apprentice Boys used to tell the police to send us away. So they'd be quite happy when we were they'd encourage us to attack these parades. But when we used to stand on the pavement watching them, their parades, they'd want us moved on, you know. But eventually we did make contact with people, yes.
And can you talk about who introduced you to the UDA? I mean, you mightn't be able to name names, but you know, how did that connection happen? And I take it you would have to have been sworn in like any other member of a prescribed organisation.
Yeah, but it didn't quite happen that way. It wasn't like going over to East Belfast, knocking on the door at Gorn Street and saying, oh, but, you know, which was the old UDA court, and saying, oh, but I'd like to join your organisation. It certainly wasn't like that, or, you know, it wasn't on the 12th, you know, whereas people have had a drink and suddenly decided they want to join the UDA or the UVF. We met somebody that was originally from Northern Ireland. He was from Lisbon, and we were led to believe he was a conduit to the UDA. So we approached him, and he introduced us to the person that was the OC for London at that time, and he was a Scotsman called Joe. Myself and a friend went along to meet him, and I've always been honest with people. I said I was thoroughly I'm impressed. He stunk with vodka. And I made it clear to the original person we'd met, there's no harm in trusting me or my friends or associates. under the leadership of this fella. And we met him one more time at a meeting place we arranged. And again, people were thoroughly unimpressed. I let them make their own minds up, you know. And then they said to me, no, we're going to follow anyone. We're going to follow you. Which was awkward because I had no experience. I wasn't a paramilitary. Right? And but what we did do, I said, look, I knew the other fella was dying to be in charge. He was just one of those people. He had that temperament. He wanted to be in charge. So we decided to let him have the administrative side of it, for want of a better way of putting it. He wasn't going to stop us doing what we wanted to do. And we had to be respectful because there was already people in and around London that were sworn in members, you know. So we played the game, but it all came to an end because one particular evening we met and a friend came along and he had a equivalent of a catalogue of weapons. And he said, oh, look, we can get this, 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 and this. And the chap went, good work, speak to Frank. And another fellow went, oh, wait a minute, you're meant to be in charge. You know, we take a dive, you take a dive. And we could see he wasn't up for it. We could see he wasn't up for it. And a few days later, we drove over to where he lived in South London. And it was five of us. And he walked in the pub and the look on his face was he just knew he wasn't welcome. And he came over and he said to me, the equivalent of I'm standing down. And I said, no, you're not. You're being fucking stood down. Don't worry about that. Of course, once that happened, that elevated me. So there you go.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig.
Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Well, it's the treadmill.
And then you became the Brigadier of London UDA, basically. And what age were you then?
I think that would have been around, mid-80s, I would say. It's documented that I took over in 1988. I was active long before that. I was active at least 3 years, I would say.
What do you mean by active, Frank?
Not in a militant sense. Just streetwise, street activities and so on. But
were you raising money for the UDA?
Raising money, selling papers, for the UDA, Lawyers Prisoners Aid. Yeah, very, very active in that. And then eventually I went to Lisbon. I went to Lisbon in... It was 86. Then I got to meet some people. I did get to meet John McMichael.
So you actually met John McMichael, who was, very...
At the time, he had the Admiral Benbow. And I went there and we spoke. I think we were a little bit of a novelty, to be honest, because we weren't Orangemen, we weren't apprentice boys. Mm-hmm. We were from the capital, of England. And I think they were keen to make some sort of links, with London. And then it just completely, I just met more and more people over the years. And the biggest job we had was straightening out the mainland. Not Scotland. It was England. Because there were groups of people all over England. And as far as we were aware, they were supposed to be a paramilitary organisation, yet we'd never heard of them doing anything. I mean, in fairness to them, they may have been supplying weapons elsewhere. But we very quickly learned that various social clubs in different towns and cities, it was almost like they were getting drinks bought for them, getting handshakes, tap on the back, and I'm thinking, hold on. You still don't strike me as being particularly militant or being paramilitary. So we would meet each area, north, Midlands, south, whatever, London. We would meet in a hotel. Each one would take turns to go, to have a meeting in a hotel, which I put a stop to. I wasn't happy about that because I said, well, what if someone's in the next room? What if there's a listening device in here? So I kind of removed myself away. I learned very quickly. Let's put it that way. I learned very, very quickly.
When was the first time you actually went to Northern Ireland? Was it after you became a member of the UDA in London, or was it before?
Let me get this straight. Yeah, because I was, yeah. Oh, no, I've been over there first. No, tell a lie. I've been there first because I was sworn in here. In fact, I remember I was sworn in a hotel in Coventry. Yeah, I was sworn in a hotel in Coventry. Actually, that's not true. I was sworn in block before that. We were presented with the London Brigade standard in a hotel in Coventry. So, but I was sworn in London. Yeah, I was sworn in London. So, yeah, I would have been sworn in before I actually went to Belfast. I beg your pardon. Yeah.
So you went, was it a big thing for you going to Northern Ireland? I mean, at this time, the Troubles we were right bang in the middle of it. Mm. Innocent people were losing their lives every day. There was bombings, there were shootings. It just didn't bother you at all that you were going over into the middle of that?
No. I very quickly learned about the various areas, you know, the geography. If you walk down the wrong street, you know, the wrong street, you've got you've got a bus or a cab to, you know, I learned that quite quickly. It was helped as well because obviously I'd got stuck to know people as well. And some people I knew had been killed. Some people that I knew had been imprisoned. So it also became very personal. It got very, very personal. But eventually, you know, I would go to, I'd fly over quite regularly, and I'd go to inner council meetings in Gong Street. So I'd met all the main players, for want of a better way of putting it. I knew a lot about the internal politics, you know. I certainly learned what a tout was very quickly. That was for sure.
That's not a term you use in London, is it?
No, it's not. No, but yes, I soon. You know, and the perception was, you know, if someone's in charge of hundreds of men, in some cases women, then they must be trustworthy, mustn't they? Because their men have put them in that position. I soon learned that's not the case. I soon learned that wasn't the case. And without jumping too far ahead, it's probably one of the biggest mistakes we made was confiding in people. Because we were obviously trying to impress. We were trying to impress that we was intending to be as militant as you and as active as you. Mm-hmm. But all that, it just drew attention to us from Special Branch and military intelligence.
When you say there was inner council meetings in Coventry, I mean, how many people were on your inner council? I know in Belfast, in areas there would have been 10, would have been a big.
You'd have had the OC and you'd have had a 2IC from London. And then you'd have had the equivalent from Liverpool, Manchester, Leeds, Sheffield, Coventry, Birmingham, Wolverhampton. And one of the reasons why I stopped attending the meetings because the next month there'd be a new 2IC. And I go, oh, well, I don't know this bloke, who's he? I think I'm going to sit in this room talking business in front of this, I don't know the fella. So eventually we stopped attending. We just stopped attending. But what we did do was we went round to try and to identify who were the most militant and who was prepared to do certain things, which didn't go down well because it disturbed the status quo. Some, you know, some people were only, you know, known in their social club for being a member of the UDA. That's the respect they got. You know, they weren't respected for anything else. So I felt they was abusing the position. So we would go around and we would talk to people and we would basically say, which we were called the Cockney upstarts. You know, it was who the fuck do they think they are? But we, you know, we meant it. And on one occasion, I won't name the club and embarrass anybody, but I went along with a friend and we went and we spoke our mind, shall we say, and when we came out of the social club, they followed us out into the car park, you know, obviously intent with salt and sound. One of us opened up their overcoat and pulled out a 9mm Browning automatic and said, keep coming. So they realised we weren't messing about. They realised we wasn't messing about. And eventually a lot of people left. But that's, you know, that's, we wanted it to be militant. We wasn't interested in selling papers and badges and so on.
I mean, when you say militant, that was going to be attacks, shootings, bombings. You didn't think about the loss of life, didn't come into your head. So I know you said you've been asked this before, but I'm going to ask it again. Do you not believe that you were radicalized?
There was an element of revenge. You know, there clearly was an element of you kick me, I'll kick you.
Right.
You know, that there was clearly that philosophy, you know. But no, I think I still stand by the fact that once I start something, I say, I won't tell you to go and do something unless I go and, you know, the old saying, you know, I wouldn't ask anybody to do something I wouldn't do myself. So it steamrolled. And once it started going, there was no going back. And the other thing is your targets become, you're less discerning about who your targets are. So it might be, you might start off with, well, we want to identify, you know, an IRA man or someone, you know, representing Sinn Féin, you know, in and around England. Then it's like, well, who supplies them information? You know, who collects money for them? Who sells their newspaper? You know, who provides their propaganda? So you start thinking, you know what, they're all eligible. Fuck them. You know, they're quite happy to contribute to killing us. Why should we be concerned about them? Even then, you don't stop. You don't realise what you're prepared to do. But that's the mantle you've taken on, isn't it? You've put yourself in that position, and that's what I say about the Tribune. Once you're on it, yeah. Till you press that red button, you don't get off. Only then you just look back and go, oh, how did I get here? But I take responsibility for that. But no, my family circumstances, you know, my social surroundings, maybe some sociologist or psychologist have a field day and say, ah, look, it's obvious. Look, he wasn't content with fighting at football. He thought, oh, yeah, I'll go fighting on the streets politically. Oh, that's not enough violence for him. He wants to join a paramilitary organisation. You can't get him. But it wasn't a bloodlust on my part. I didn't get involved to inflict violence, but I certainly got involved to make a statement and go, hold on. You know, you're not going to do this and just think you're going to get away with it. And that might sound strange now, but that's just the atmosphere as it was at the time.
Frank, maybe it's not a question you want to answer, but I'll ask it anyway. How many people were killed, if any, when you were commander of London UDA in the mainland?
No.
How many attacks were carried out when you were commander?
Well, I'll put it this way. I'd have to say, again, none. But there were reasons why. And that was partly because of good intelligence as far as the security services were concerned. Well, and also, look, if you sat in the back of a car with two military intelligence officers and they tell you chapter and verse about an operation that you were planning on being part of, and eventually you sit there and go, all right, they nick me. Because you start to realise, oh, well, I'm sitting in the back of a car. I'm not sitting in the police station, am I? I'm sitting in the back of a car. So they're not going to nick me, are they? So what they did was they said, we'll give you enough rope and you'll hang yourself. And 2 years later, I did hang myself. But there was also situations where people from Belfast actively encouraged us to do certain things. And we would spend months planning on doing it, you know, doing reconnaissance, etc., on certain people. And then we get told, oh, we've had some information from an RUC officer who's got a contact over in London, and they've told him that they're currently watching a group of people in London. You better watch yourself, lads. So you'd have to cancel what you did. Oh, you better be political for 6 months. So it wasn't as if there wasn't intent And we know why we drew attention to ourselves. We know why we drew attention to ourselves, because we let it be known that, as far as we were concerned, that if British MPs who supported the union could be targets, like Ian Gow, for example, then why should British MPs that supported the United Ireland, or more to the point, we believed, supported the IRA, why weren't they targets? Why weren't they being targeted? You know.
And there was two plots to kill Ken Livingstone, who was mayor of London at that time, and that was a UFF plot. Michael Stone revealed one of those, and then you revealed the other in your book, and you had said, Frank, that the plan was to shoot Ken Livingstone as he was at a Bloody Sunday march in 1993 in Hyde Park. And you had described that in detail in your book. Do you want to tell people how, I mean, that came about?
Well, purely because we felt that if he wanted to continue to support these people, and be quite vocal about it, quite proud of it, then we needed to make an example. If thousands of people thought they could keep walking up and down Edgware Road singing IRA, I'm not saying they all did, just let's get that straight, but they were clearly prepared to walk behind bands that were playing IRA tunes and have some prominent Sinn Féin people at the head of the parade. So, you know, I think the thinking behind it was, well, if you think you're safe on them parades, you're not safe. And there's one way of proving you're not safe, and for want of a better way of putting it, you know, you take the head off the snake. And that's why people like him were identified, and John McDonnell, and Jeremy Corbyn. Because as far as we were concerned, those three were the enemy. It's as simple as that. We saw them as the enemy. And in the case of Livingstone, he was a very, very lucky man, because they were all in Hyde Park, and it's only because there were so many protesters there. I mean, 370-odd people were taken off the streets in green buses and taken to police stations. We would say there was over 1,000 people there opposing that parade that day, and that was the whole idea, to have that cover of people there. And we'd encouraged all them people to be there. There was no mobiles in those days. We were literally going around the country encouraging people to be there on that day. And they wouldn't come out the park. They would not come out of Hyde Park. And that's where things started to go wrong. And the irony is, we mentioned this to the police, to senior police officers on the day. You know, isn't it ironic? You see the people standing in that park who's asking you to protect them. I said, give a cheer every time. And your colleagues back in Northern Ireland, the IUC, get killed. Now they're asking for your protection. You don't find it ironic, you know? But yeah, there's no doubt about it. He was a very lucky man that day.
And what happened was the UFF had planned to, when the protesters came out, there's going to be confusion made with your side, and people, fights would break out, and the hope would be to get Ken Livingstone and shoot him.
Well, we'd get close enough within all the, you know, the mayhem that would have been going on. That would have been the opportunity, yeah.
Frank, do you not? I mean, many years have passed, and I can understand that over the years that there would have been a little bit of, negativity from unionists and loyalists around Bloody Sunday. The facts are fully known now. There was 13 people murdered indiscriminately that day. There was no members of the IRA by paratroopers. Have you ever reflected on that and realised, well, I mean, maybe these people were protesting for a reason? And they were. I mean, it's been proven that the British Prime Minister had to apologise to the families of Bloody Sunday for what happened, because,
I recognise that at the very beginning. I have tried to distinguish between people that may have a legitimate reason to ask for inquiries, to protest on the streets. I'm not denying anybody their democratic right to do that. far from it. But who they associate with while they're doing it is a completely different is a completely different subject. Because where do you draw the line? Because we all know that people can, you may have proved that themselves. You know, you can wear two masks. You know, so someone walking along and claiming, "Oh, I'm only here today because blah 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 blah." Well, that might sound very moralistic, you know, and idealistic. What are they really thinking? You know, you seem quite comfortable walking behind bands playing IRA tunes. Why is that? You know, and quite militant messages on banners. And, you know, so I'm sorry if you know, as I just said to me, if you lay down with dogs, you've got to expect to pick up a few fleas. And you know, that's the way we viewed it at the time. You're traitors, you're enemy, you're the enemy. You know, the trade unions, the amount of trade unions that took part in those, you know, fights. You know, working class people in London were getting blown up. You're supposed to be trade unionists. You don't care about those people just because they've got a different political opinion to you. So I wasn't, you know, it wasn't a bloodlust. It wasn't about going around and attacking people just because they had a difference of opinion to you. That's not the case. That's not the case at all. But people we felt were acting as mouthpieces for it, you know, were legitimate as far as I'm aware. And let's get something straight as well. I was a legitimate target, right? I don't expect any protection. I was putting myself out there to be attacked as well. And even to a certain degree, even today, you know, I accept that. I'd be a legitimate target. I don't have a problem with that.
Did you expect to die? Did you expect to be targeted? Did you expect? No, you didn't. That never crossed your mind.
That's the craziness. That's the craziness. As I say, I don't want to make you sound like you're being blasé, but I was probably certainly complacent, because as I say, you're only doing it through your eyes, and you're only doing what other people are following you. You don't look, as I say, you don't look left, you don't look right, you don't look behind. You just focus on your job and achieving what you're encouraging other people to do. You just don't have time to think. I do now, clearly.
When you were running the UDA in London, in Northern Ireland, John McMichael was being blown up by an IRA car bomb. Other people in the UDA were being shot, sometimes by their own. I mean, all this was going on. Mm. I mean, how were you receiving that information? I mean, were you being told this stuff from people back in Northern Ireland? Oh, yeah. I assume that you were getting orders from?
Well, I was going there so often, so I knew what was going on. And I'm glad you mentioned John McMichael again, because when we were talking about something else, I was about to say that, you know, I'm very much a follower of John McMichael. So the term that I use now is what he would use, which was one of nobody was exclusively right and nobody was exclusively wrong. So in that sense, if we can start from there, you know, we might get somewhere. You know, we may well be able to live with each other and find a better way. So, yeah, I remember that quite vividly. When he was blown up. And unfortunately, many, many other situations. And one of the men that were thought to be responsible for that, Jim Craig, on the night he was killed, two OCs from Belfast were sitting in my house having dinner. Tuck a little, right? And I won't name the other one. Were sitting in my house. They never told, they knew it was going to go on that night. They knew that Jim Craig was going to be lured to the Castle Inn or the Bunch of Grapes. It would have been, its last name was the Bunch of Grapes before it got shut down. And killed. They didn't tell me. But basically, that was their alibi. So they didn't even have the decency to tell me that they were using me as an alibi. So this is where I say you learn, don't you? You start looking at people. You start learning about people. And even if they are in charge of hundreds of people or thousands of people, you start to question them. And as I say, I knew where we went wrong was to go to Belfast and say that we felt certain people back in England were legitimate targets. Because clearly, some of them obviously told their handlers that. And then we got so much attention, it was ridiculous. We got followed so much, it was ridiculous. You know, to the degree it was blatant sometimes, just to say to you, don't get any ideas. Don't get any ideas, because we're one step behind you.
Were you thinking at that time, when this was happening, you were being followed, did you ever put two and two together and think, well, I've been over to Belfast. I've told people this. I suppose maybe you'd mentioned that. Was your head been filled with, you know, ideas like, oh, you're being bugged, you're being this, when in reality, actually, there's just a few touts back in Belfast and they're trying to bring the special
mansion. And I identify even more now, looking back on certain situations, certain conversations. You know, I think there was a time when I sat around that table and there would be six other people, and I reckon three of them were touts. Easy. That's just my gut instinct without any proof. So, yeah, you eventually you do learn. You do learn. And that's acceptable, isn't it? It's acceptable, I should say. You know, the authorities are quite open about it, the amount of people that they had working, you know, for them. Mm-hmm. And in hindsight, people used to say to me, do you blame for getting caught? Well, I would blame myself, quite frankly. But looking back on it, I can identify somebody now. I can definitely identify somebody.
The very first time I read about your case, and it was May 1993, you were arrested in the car park of a Birmingham pub, handing over 7 guns and 240 rounds of ammunition to a man from Belfast. And then the cops just appeared out of nowhere.
Yeah.
Do you think an informant was involved in you getting arrested? And, I mean, to be quite honest, it's good that they were, because, I mean, we don't know where those guns were going. We don't know what innocent lives were going to be taken. 240 rounds of ammunition, 1993, the year we had Grey Steel, and I'm only talking about Loyalist atrocities. There was other IRA atrocities, like the Shankill bombing, but there was Grey Steel, there was Castle Rock, there was atrocities. It was a dark year.
Yeah,
so we're taking off. But my question is, do you believe that there was a police informant who in the UDA at that time that was giving that information to the police about you?
I do now.
How long did it take you to realise that?
Well, because I could think of probably half a dozen different permutations it could have been. But eventually, I believe I put enough of the pieces together to realise it went back to one particular person. And then when I got out of prison and went to Belfast, there seemed to be a popular opinion as well that it was the same person. I didn't let on who I thought it was. I was waiting to see what other people said. And it turned out that, But again, I'm saying that it could have been sloppiness on our part. It could have been too blasé on our part. You know, it wasn't as if we weren't being watched. We just didn't know how well we were being watched. But we did know that there would be more effort into catching us if they got proper information. And on this occasion, they had proper information, clearly.
It was said in court that you had been supplying guns to the UDA in Northern Ireland for 18 months prior to that. Mm. How many guns do you think you supplied?
Oh, dozens. Dozens. Over the course of time, there have been dozens. Were we
getting these guns? Were these from gangsters in London? Were they coming from abroad? Where were you getting them from?
Well, some were villains. Some were villains that I did know. And some were ex-army fellas that I knew as well. So it was a combination of the two. And I'd like to say something at this point, because as I say, a lot of rubbish gets regurgitated time and time again. And I think the media need to take some responsibility here. Because when I was caught, they did the Daily Mail did a Mail on Sunday magazine, and they did a 4-page spread on me. And various other publications did as well. And it was clearly meant to alienate me from my own people, so to speak. And it's amazing how they used the term, I was caught with a ropey old haul of weapons. Well, on the day of sentencing, that turned into a deadly arsenal. How did that happen? How did it go from a ropey old haul of weapons to a deadly arsenal of weapons?
Does it really matter if they're ropey or old, because they're still weapons? But I get what you're saying. It was done to
demean me and undermine me. And things like, where did they get the picture of the photos of me in a category A, you know, white paper suit? Where did they get the photographs of the guns on the floor of the car park? And when an associate of mine approached the journalist, and he put it to him that basically you've written anything the police want you to write in exchange for the photographs. And he admitted it straight away. He didn't make any bones about it. He said that. And I think the thing is, that can endanger somebody. That can endanger, misinformation can endanger somebody. And it's happened to me again recently. It's happened to me again, even now, last year, where it was said in the Sunday World that I'd extended the hand of friendship to Johnny Adair. Now, that's rubbish. In fact, it's not rubbish, it's a lie. It's a dangerous lie. It's a very, very dangerous lie. Because when I go to Northern Ireland, there could be people take exception to that if they believe it. Fortunately enough, people I know don't believe it. But that was a conversation that I was asked what my relationship was with Johnny. And I said, you need to remember, when I came out of prison, C Company looked after me. C Company entertained me. C Company gave me money to take home to my family. And I'm not going to forget that. There's no way I'm going to forget that. And the comment I made was, if I was walking through an airport and Johnny was walking towards me, my natural instinct would be to walk up and shake his hand because of back then. But because of the feud and because of the death of John Gregg, who was a personal friend, I carried his coffin part of the way, you know, at his funeral. I can't do that. I couldn't do that. And Johnny understands that. Johnny understands that. But that newspaper, that reporter, chose to put in his paper that I have extended the hand of friendship to Johnny. Now, that could endanger me. So, you know, I've got a lot of previous where the press have got a lot to ask for. And even in the UDA book, you go and get the UDA book, The History of the UDA, by Henry McDonald and Jim Cusack. They didn't got my name wrong. They got my name wrong. They called me James. I think they got the sentence. And it's the bit that particularly offended me was the bit where they said that drugs charges. I've never sort of drug in my life. I hate drugs. Can't stand them. Can't stand drugs. They want nothing to do with drugs. Now, of course, as I said to you earlier, these things get regurgitated, and sloppy and lazy journalists just repeat it and repeat it. And I've come across my name all over the place on the internet. I'll find things out about me I didn't know. That's for sure. You know. So, yeah, but listen, if you don't get involved, these things don't happen, do they? So I'll take it on the chin.
I have read the articles that you mentioned. It was one of the things I was going to bring up about Johnny Adair, because it conflicted with the fact that you were John Gregg's friend. Mm. And for anyone who doesn't know, John Gregg was brutally murdered in 2003 on his way home to Belfast from Scotland. He was shot dead. He was the leader of South East Antrim UDA at that time. He was killed in a loyalist feud. His murder caused huge ructions within loyalism, and it was part of the reason that Johnny Adair I mean, had to leave Northern Ireland, and I've interviewed Johnny on this show.
Yeah, when
that murder happened at that time, Frank, can you remember? I mean, first of all, as that being your friend, how did you receive that news?
Well, I got a phone call, and I knew what the implications were going to be. It didn't take a lot. I mean, apart from the initial shock of it, you know, and the sadness, because I was in a family, and many of his friends and associates. But I knew what the repercussions were going to be, which was going to affect other friends and associates, and that's never good. That's never good. And again, I can only say I wish none of it had happened. I was talking to a Republican a few weeks ago, and I said to him, I just wish you'd gone the way of the SDLP. I wish you'd have gone the way of the SDLP and not picked the militant path, you know. And I know that I know things were bad. I know things were bad back then. And I know there were social injustices. I accept that. I also think there were social injustices on the Lloyd's side as well, by the way. But it's sometimes it's hard to distinguish between those that were protesting for civil rights and those that were protesting for United Ireland, you know, i.e. using the cover of the civil rights movement. Sometimes it was the lines were very, very blurred. And I just wish the Catholic nationalist community had followed the SDLP, because and I don't believe we'd have had so much bloodshed. I certainly wouldn't have got involved, that's for sure. I certainly wouldn't have got involved. And I'm not saying that for selfish reasons, by the way. I'm saying it's for everybody, whichever side of the community. And I make a point of saying to people, now, young people, you know, do yourselves a favour. You've got far more in common with each other, you know, than what you've got against each other. And I see a young man get questioned, and it was, I thought he was going to be set up. He was being interviewed when the riots started again briefly. And I spoke to this young man, and he said, no, he said, I'm going to join the Navy. He said, I'm going to learn a trade. He said, and then I'm going to come back to my community, and I'm going to help my community. And I thought, well done, young man. Well done. You're not going to go and throw a petrol bomb, ruin your life, ruin somebody else's life. You're going to go and get an education, you're going to come back, and you're going to assist your community. And I hope the young man on the other side of the wall is thinking exactly the same way. I hope they're all thinking that way. I know they all might want to take a few years to get around to doing it, but it's a good start. It's refreshing to see that, if I'm honest. Yeah.
That's good, because I was going to ask you about your current opinion on the state of loyalism at the minute. And I know 10 years ago that you were a guest in Dublin to celebrate a commemoration for British soldiers, which was a huge thing in the Irish Republic.
Yeah. And Irish soldiers, I hasten to add. Yeah, and Irish soldiers. I've had invitations, and I've had Her Majesty's pleasure twice. And I've got to say, the second time was far better than the first time. that was a very surreal day. That to hear both national anthems played, both flags, you know, both lots of soldiers, and there was a big marquee, and we all mixed, and we all spoke to each other, and so yeah, very surreal day. Very honoured to have been there. And I'd like to think that was some recognition that my position had changed, and I wanted to work for peace. And in fact, I won't go into it now, but there's something going on later in the year. I've been invited somewhere, and I will be meeting a very prominent IRA man, very, very well known man. I can't say it at the moment for security reasons, but. Which is a bit of a challenge for me, if I'm honest. But
big step for you, yeah.
But if it gives an example to younger people, then I'm prepared to take that step.
I think that's a positive thing, Frank. I mean, we can demonize and vilify people to the end of time. I think it's more important that we learn lessons from the past.
I will go there for the 12th, and that is purely to be amongst old friends. I'm not there for political reasons. Certainly not there for military reasons. It's to go. It's enjoy the occasion, meet old friends, because we're all, you know, look, so many of them are dying, you know, or so many of them are dead. You know, the old you know, UDA fellas that I knew, you know, in their 70s, you know, 80s. And every year, you know, some of them are dying. So it's the last opportunity to actually to go and meet them. But we don't sit there reminiscing about the troubles, that's for sure, the conflict, that's for sure. Mm-hmm. We go to enjoy each other's company while we're still here, you know.
What is your opinion on loyalism at the moment, Frank, because, I mean, it's associated with drug dealing a lot. I know we hear about the protocol, but, I mean, a lot of people, and even loyalists themselves, former people who would have spent life sentences or long sentences in for political reasons in Northern Ireland would say that loyalism now, there are too many loyalist groups connected with drugs. They are more like organized crime gangs who wrap themselves in the flag.
Yeah, you know, I couldn't argue with that. It's become a career for some people. It's just become a career move for some people, and I wouldn't be welcome in some areas because I would be outspoken about that. There's no doubt about that. I won't go into detail, but I was actually out of an area. Under the guise of something else, as far as I'm concerned, I actually believe it was more the fact my opinion on drugs and you know the influence on the communities, particularly young people. And I'm not going to go back on that. I should stick with that view, you know. So it's ironic that someone that never lifted a finger, certainly didn't lose their liberty, is now exerting power over other people, you know.
There are more recruits now than there was in the Troubles. I think there's 12,500 people, members of loyalist organisations. Now, a loyalist said to me that the reason he believes there are more recruits now than there was in the Troubles is because now you don't have to do anything. Thank God.
I think you've hit the nail on the head. I think you've had exactly that. And the fact that, look, I understand it. If your father, your uncles, even your grandfather, have done what they would deem done their bit, whether it's the late 60s through the 70s, 80s, 90s, I understand that they want to be seen to be doing their bit. You know, they want to keep that tradition going. Their family, if your family is known in a street as being respected loyalists, I can understand why a young man would want some of that kudos. I get it. But if they're going to join, yeah, I'm glad they're doing it now. Because it's totally inactive. It's totally inactive. So I'm quite content with that.
You're working on your second book?
Yes, that's correct.
Is that right?
Yeah.
So when's that going to be out?
Well, that's going to be far more reflective. Half of it will kind of go back to the past, but the second half will be far more reflective and answer probably some of the questions that you may well ask in the future. But as I say, I've got this big thing at the end of September, and if it goes to plan, then maybe in October, because it will be public by then. And I will be able to speak about it far more openly, plus my response, you know, how that's gone. But yeah, and again, I'll just say before we do go, thanks very much for the invitation, giving me an opportunity to put certain things straight, and a lot of respect for what you're doing, because I've watched them all so far. I don't obviously intend to watch the ones in future. And if it gets people, you know, with similar backgrounds to myself, to sit and listen to each other, you know, maybe we can all do a bit of good somewhere down the line.
Absolutely, Frank. And thank you so much again for coming. I really appreciate it. This podcast is about getting voices out there because, like I said, I believe it's my own personal opinion. If we don't learn from the past, I mean, you know, we can't demonize people forever. We have to learn. We have to.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.